planning to until later when Peter and Ted are signing, because it's really distracting if there's pictures going on during the event. I am Elaine Petrocelli, and I have the privilege of being the president of Book Passage and working closely with Dominican University of California, especially the Leadership Institute led by Dr. Denise Lucy. This is part of our spring lecture series, and you probably saw flashing on the screen that Susie Orman will be here Thursday to tell us all about money, and Caroline Kennedy will be here for her book, She Walks in Beauty, on April 13th. And Dr. Abraham Verghese, the author of Cutting for Stone, will be here in conversation with Michael Krasny on April 27th. That is the final event of the One Book, One Marin, celebrating Cutting for Stone. You know, the Institute for Leadership Studies is a really fascinating place. It facilitates positive individual, organizational, societal change. Can you imagine all that? Engaged citizenship and socially responsible leadership. That's what they wrote for me. But what it really is a fabulous program to bring leaders into our community. And every semester, the Institute hosts forums to engage current and future leaders. And recent speakers that Book Passage and Dominican have hosted as part of this series include Vice President Al Gore, Isabel Allende, Paul Hawken, Daniel Goldman, Rick Steves. So we hope that you'll get on our list and come to all of them. Tonight, we are very privileged to have Ted Danson, and about 20 people asked me how we got him. So I'm going to tell you how our secret. Our secret is a woman named Karen West, who went to New York and spoke to a fabulous woman in Rodale Publishing, Yelena Gitlin, and told her why Ted Danson needed to come to Dominican to speak here. And if you know Karen West, you know you can't say no to her. And so Yelena couldn't say no. Yelena's here tonight, so you can thank her for that and other authors that she's brought us. Now, Ted and Peter are going to be introduced tonight by Chris Gallagher. A lot of you know Chris. She is the head of the Women's Leadership Institute here at Dominican, a group of women who are working for the future of this great university. Chris is the park manager for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers at the Bay Model. And if you haven't been to the Bay Model lately, Chris would like you to come. About 150,000 visitors come every year, and it is so important to see it and to see how our bay works, because it is a hydraulic model of the entire bay. And it is, including the San Joaquin Delta. It is really amazing. I don't know how she keeps track of it, but perhaps it is because she is a graduate of Dominican University. So Chris Gallagher, thank you.
Thank you, Elaine. Our guests tonight are a pair of well-known environmental activists, Peter Coyote and Ted Danson. Peter, who lives in Marin County, is an actor, author, director, screenwriter, narrator, and I learned at the reception just previous to this, was born in a manger here in Marin. Didn't know that, but given it's a Catholic institution, I thought I should say that. He's currently cast in HBO's production of Hemingway and Gellhorn, starring Clive Owen and Nicole Kidman. Next month, Peter will begin shooting the story of Bonnie and Clyde, a new adaptation and remake of the 1967 movie Bonnie and Clyde, starring Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty. Ted is a multiple Emmy and Golden Globe award-winning actor who has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and is currently starring with his wife, Mary Stimberger, in HBO's comedy series, Bored to Death. You probably remember Ted's life has been anything but boring. He's best known for his role as Sam as Mayday Malone in his long-running hit series, Cheers. He then went on to become a doctor in the series Becker, which are both on reruns and I watch very often. Ted was bartending back then, and now he's serving another capacity. He's tending to our oceans as one of the world's most influential oceanic environmental activists. I, as Elaine said, work at the Bay Model, and for 26 years, the Bay Model has been the coordinator for Marin County in cleaning the creeks and the bay during coastal cleanup, which is the third Saturday of every month in September. So I have followed the work of Ted for quite a while. So in Oceana, our planet's endangered oceans and what we can do to save them, Ted deals how joining a modest local protest to oppose offshore drilling near a Southern California neighborhood eventually led him to devote himself to the cause of heading off massive destruction of the planet's oceanic biosystems and complete collapse of the world's major commercial fisheries. So inspired was Ted that he helped found Oceana, the largest organization in the world focused solely on ocean conservation. I salute Ted for his tireless efforts and boundless energy, dedicated as an environmentalist with a keen and deeply caring eye on the state of the world's oceans. For this I say cheers. Please welcome actor, author, activist Ted Danson, along with his friend and fellow actor and activist Peter Coyote.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That was great.
Thank you. Welcome, everybody. Is this microphone on? You can hear me? I can fill this room without it. Thank you very much for coming. I'd like to thank Book Passage and Dominican College for being our hosts. And I need to tell you how happy I am to see my pal Ted again and how I am not surprised that this is a brilliant, hard-thought, beautifully crafted book. And for those of you that have the remotest interest in the oceans, this is an A to Z primer. It's really impeccably done. And although we both make our living pretending to be other people, I think precisely because of that, we're in no doubt about when we're being ourselves or when we're following our passions. And Ted has followed this passion for a long time. And although you may not know him in this role so much, before we start, I want to ask you to give the audience a little bit of a frame for the evening.
Great.
About your interest, about oceans, and anything you'd like to do.
First off, thank you for wrapping your big old brain around this subject and doing this with me. I so appreciate that you're here. Just so it's not too weird that Sam Malone's going to talk to you about fish and how to save the oceans, I thought maybe I'd just give you a little bit of how I got here, because it seems strange to me even. I'm signing the book going, what am I doing signing a book? This is so strange. I grew up in Arizona, Flagstaff. My father was an archaeologist and a director of a museum and a research center. And there wasn't a night in the summer that didn't go by that we didn't dine four or five scientists from all over the world. So I was surrounded by that, and I'd go out on his digs, my sister and I, and we'd play with skulls, and well, we'd find a skull and get whisked away, and then the professionals would come in. But I think what I got from him, even though I was playing with my friends and much more concerned about my, you know, riding horses and all of that, that there's a lot that has come before us, and there's a lot that has come after us, and this time that you're here is not just about you, it's about your stewardship of what you've been given. And then I want to mention my mother, who made sure we went to church a lot, and I like to, we're all on a spiritual path, but I like to think that my mother really actively pursued her life from a spiritual point of view. And I bring that up because I think that any conversation pretty much about anything to do with the environment, but I'll just stick with oceans. Any conversation you have about oceans needs to include both science and spirituality. Science, because you could do more wrong, you know, in your attempt to do good, if you don't let science lead the way, you could actually harm it or do nothing at, you know, at worst. And spirituality, because we're all in this together. You know, if we clean up our oceans and have impeccable fishing management systems and all of that, and the rest of the world doesn't, so what? We literally, everything we do has an impact on everybody else. I'm preaching to the choir. But I love this conversation about oceans for that reason. Okay, flash forward, middle of Cheers. They're paying me too much money. I'm guilty. What do I do with it? I moved to a neighborhood in Santa Monica Bay, and I'm walking with my daughters, Kate and Katrina, and they're like 8 and 4, and we come across the sign, you know, beach closed, water's polluted, and trying to explain to them how or why that could be, and had no idea, you know, and it was a gorgeous day, just crystal clear, beautiful. Also, around that time, ran into a man named Bob Sulnick, who was the, pardon me, the head of No Oil, Inc., which was trying to keep Occidental Petroleum from digging about 60 oil wells right along Will Rogers State Beach in Santa Monica Bay. And we won that battle, and we enjoyed each other's company, and we thought, this is fun. It was almost, you know, my father has a barn, let's put on a play. Let's do this, let's start an environmental organization. And we went down to Scripps and talked to my marine biologist brother-in-law, and we were off and running. And we hired a lobbyist, and we got a lot of support from Barbara Boxer and George Miller and then Senator and Leon Panetta and Senator Al Gore, and all of these people were very encouraging of us, even though, you know, we were this small kind of celebrity boutique ocean organization. But the staff was really good. Then we merged with Oceana about 10 years ago, and I'm on the board of directors of Oceana. And I have always been the actor who stood in front of the tent saying, hey, thank you so much for watching Cheers. Come on in and let me introduce you to this marine biologist that has this really interesting stuff to tell you. And basically, that is the book. It's me introducing you and sharing with you the people that I've met, the things that I've learned over the last 20 years. And they're all scientists and a mate. Well, not, they're cooks, they're surfers, they're a whole mess of different people. One last thing, and then we're off and running. The splashy, sexy headline that I can say, because I'm an actor and not a scientist, is some scientists believe that if we keep fishing in the destructive and wasteful way we are, we could literally, commercially, fish out our oceans in the next 60, 70, whatever years. That's the unscientific part, because you can't pick a date, you know, that's crazy. But no one argues with the fact that that is the direction we're heading. Since 1988, the fish count has gone down every year. More and more boats out on the water, fewer and fewer fish being caught. I think we should cut in and start having our conversation, and then we'll have questions. But sorry, I just wanted to set a little.
I'm glad you did.
Good. I'm still Sam Malone. I'm still really like the least, you know, qualified person to be doing this, but here I am. And if you ask too hard a question, I'm an actor.
Well, there's a long tradition of paraprofessionals in the world, people who are not professionals at what they do, but who've driven the science and the study forward. And I think of you in that capacity. I'm going to pull a number of statistics from the book, and I've checked these statistics. So much as I love and respect them, it's my ass up here too, I'm going to check the numbers. But it'll keep the conversation real.
And we should say that he checked fact, we made ahead a check fact error, and he caught it. It was one little teeny like sentence, and he nailed it.
It wasn't a little error.
There were three words, let me put it that way. They were big words, but.
Yeah. I'll actually clue you, and I'll say now at a certain point in the evening. So the truth is that we've lost 90% of sharks, bluefin tuna, swordfish, marlin, and king mackerel. And if I were to hazard a guess, I'd say the greatest part of those losses are certainly within the last 80 years.
Definitely.
Just to set the frame, what does this mean for the health of the oceans and for the survival of human culture as we know it?
Well, I think it's just an indicator that is the direction we're going, that we are, by the wasteful and indiscriminate and thinking that the ocean and its bounty is endless, that we will never have to pay the piper. And that those figures actually come from when you and I were growing up in the 50s. Mm-hmm. You know, those fish that were around, they're now 90% less of them. The important thing to realize, and it's hard for us to get it, because you can go into any restaurant here and have a great piece of fish, what's the problem? But in the southern hemisphere, the fish are getting smaller and smaller and farther and fewer in between. And the reason why we care, and this is not about saving fish, this is about saving fishermen, if anything. 1 billion people in the world depend on fish for their protein, and that's usually in the poor, mostly in the poorer countries. So it's a world hunger issue. 200 million people make their livelihood out of fishing. This is I like approaching it not just from the moral standpoint, but just from the practical economic standpoint. You have a $100 billion a year industry, and you're going to blow it because you're not harvesting in a smart, capitalistic, smart, smart, greedy
sustainable
way. Yeah, I mean, think, you know, be greedy, but do it and be smart so that you can continue to harvest forever and ever.
Well, one of the things that I read, just reading on the issue, that people might not have connected, everyone has read about the Somali pirates that are stealing these oil tankers and exacting ransom. Many people don't realize that they used to be fishermen and that their fishing grounds were wiped out by the long line freighters and the big foreign fishermen. So I want to turn this a little bit. It's onto a moral edge. The United States has 2%.
Can I just do a parenthesis?
Yes.
Did I tell you about that CNN thing 2 or 3 months ago? They did a whole thing about the Kenyan fishermen who had big smiles because their boats were crammed with fish for the first time in decades. I'm not advocating piracy, but because the Somalian pirates had chased away all of the big, huge international fishing fleets, they were too scared to come in the water. So the moral is, and it's not about pirates, is fish, when given a chance, will come back. That's the good news, you know?
That's a great story.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So the U.S. has 2% of the world's population, and we consume 25% of the world's resources, which includes food, okay? We do it because we can. And to me, that's immoral on the face of it. But how would you, knowing the breadth of people that you do and being involved in this issue from top and bottom, how would you frame the argument to voluntarily limit our consumption or alter it to consumers, to fishermen, and to corporations?
Right. I always try to do it not from a goody-two-shoes from a way that can be dismissed. The discussion nowadays is the economy, jobs. So I just keep trying to do it from, you can come at it from, like I said, you can come at it from science or spirituality or the economy or jobs or whatever, any way you want to approach it. If you do the right thing for the environment, you will do the right thing for jobs and for the economy and for your spirit, and okay, I'm rambling my way right out of an answer. What was your first fact? 20%?
2% of the world's population, right. 25% of the resources. How would you frame your arguments to consumers, to fishermen, to corporations, however you want to make the argument?
Right. Well, I'm going to have to stick to oceans and fish, even though we consume many other things. Because this country actually has a pretty good record. Well, right now we're managing our fisheries pretty well. And when I said that 30% of the world's fisheries have collapsed, I get mail from scientists who say we are not overfishing our fisheries anymore. put that in context, though, that's we're not overfishing that 10% or whatever the percentage is that's left.
That's left.
Right. What do I want to say about this? Ask it me some other way.
So does that mean that we're holding that 10% as a line, as future breeding stock?
No, see, that's the problem, that when you have a quota that is so just barely, okay, we're right at the line of overfishing this stock. Well, first off, if your stocks have been so depleted over the years that you're barely not fishing them, you know, in a bad way, and it's this much, along comes something like ocean acidification or the water temperature rises or something that you can't foresee, you could literally collapse, you know, the fishery because you haven't counted on the unforeseen. The 2%, you know, that figure, well, my brain's getting jammed, I use that figure, the 2% of, we have 2% of the oil underneath it, and we consume 20% of the world's oil. And the reason why, as an ocean person, we talk about oil, obviously oil spills if they land on top of a reef or some environmentally sensitive fishery or something, it's horrible. But the real problem is that we are burning so much carbon, fossil fuels, and putting so much carbon dioxide up into the atmosphere that the oceans, historically, their job have been to absorb carbon dioxide. But now, and this is not a debatable thing. This is not cyclical or maybe it's climate or what. This is us burning carbon fuels. Turns the ocean acidic. It changes the pH balance. And by doing that, the ocean becomes a little more acidic, and the sea snails and the pteropods and the little beginnings of the food chain that depend on calcium to make their shells cannot form the shells. The calcium won't bind together. So at the same time you are overfishing the top of the food chain, you are running the risk of having things like ocean acidification starting to eat away at the bottom of the food chain. You could literally squeeze the life out of the ocean, which is why some people say you could commercially fish out our ocean.
So,
but I didn't answer your question.
I'm going to get at it another way.
Yeah, go.
Yeah, I'm going to get at it another way. A couple of years ago, I narrated and was on-camera narrator on a film about grazing beef on public land.
Right.
And people were trying to protect the land, the grasslands, kind of like the ocean. And cows were eating the shade and messing up the rivers. And I said on this show that it seems to me that when America changes its mind and decides it wants to begin an environmental shift or decides it wants to start taking care of the oceans, that it seems patently unfair to ask the fishermen to bear the brunt of it. We give billions of dollars in subsidies to Archer Daniels Midlands, to huge agro-industrial combines, not to grow food. And yet, are we asking these fishermen to bear the brunt of their mortgages, their payments on their ships, their house payments? Shouldn't there be some kind of national policy that takes the livelihoods of these people into account and say, if you can't fish, we have to help
you? Sure, sure. This is worldwide. We're pretty good about not over-subsidizing our fishing fleets. The rest of the world is terrible. It's an $80 to $100 billion a year landed fish take. And $25 billion of that every year is subsidized to buy fuel for the big ships so they can go out further than they could possibly otherwise, to increase the capacity, to make the engines bigger. In other words, you're paying with tax dollars to have them go out and do more damage to the sea. We have twice the amount of boats out on the water than could possibly sustainably fish. This country does not do that. So I agree that we should take those subsidies to help people who can't catch enough fish to stay alive. But the truth is, you still need to get boats off the water. Mm-hmm. You still need to have the quotas be, you know, low enough so that the fish stock can come back. No matter how you cut it, you cannot overfish, and you can maybe pay for people to get their boats, and you can pay for people to train them to do something else. But basically, you're going to need to have less fishermen out of the water.
I see.
Taking up less fish.
Well, what is our leverage as citizens? Obviously, if we want to change the quotas, we have to affect the law. And the people with the most vested interest in that law are the corporate fishermen. So what is the leverage that we can employ, do you think, as citizens to counter that and say we need these laws?
Well, once again, this country is pretty good at that. The World Trade Organization right now is has language for the first time ever that is environmental in nature. They are looking at cutting the subsidies to the world fishing fleets because everyone knows that they're oversubsidized. Of course, when you go there, everyone agrees, but it's not my country. It's,
yeah.
It's his. You know.
I was in Spain when the fishermen were rioting last year.
Yeah, and Spain's one of the worst, by the way. So one of the things we can do is support our congressmen and senators who are united as Democrats and Republicans because it's unfair to our fishermen that we don't subsidize them and the other countries do. So it's an uneven playing field. So everybody's in favor of this. But if that could happen, if the World Trade Organization could come to an agreement with the Doha round that had still had language in it that cut fish subsidies, that would be huge. Because, and the argument is jobs, once again. 90% of the fishermen in the world are artisanal fishermen who, by and large, do it the right way, and they catch 10% of the fish. 10% of the workforce work on those huge, you know, almost super tanker-sized fishing vessels, and they get 90% of the world's catch.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there you have the very economic efficiency is working against the livelihoods of most of the people who are involved.
Yeah.
Here's something that you taught me about oil, which I didn't know, and so I'm going to assume that the audience doesn't know it.
I might not know it. Go ahead.
At 100 parts per million, oil is considered hazardous waste. 100 parts per million, and 1 million drops of water, 1 drop of oil, makes that vessel hazardous waste. Now let me just run down this list from Ted's book a second. The BP oil spill dropped 171 million of gallons of oil into the Gulf. And I don't know if you read Naomi Wolf's recent article. They're finding it's still there. It's in plumes underwater. Yeah. But that was just one. Spain dropped 23 million gallons in 2002. Pakistan dropped 86 million in 2003. The Philippines in 2006, South Korea in 2007, the UK in 2008, Australia in 2009 and 10, and South Vietnam in 2010. And the industry calls business as usual, normal leaks, spills, ruptures, broken valves, at 15 million barrels to our ocean. So my question to you is that this is obviously a worldwide cultural problem. Every one of us who drives a car, uses plastic, flips a light switch, is a codependent to this issue. What do we do tomorrow? And then what do we aim at long term? Is it the end of petroleum?
I don't know.
I see.
Really, I drive in a car. I'm not Ed Begley, you know, who...
Nor am I.
Literally walks the walk. I mean, the guy... I like to take my limo and drive real close to his bicycle and just splash it.
I'm not making you responsible for coming up with an answer, but I'm sort of asking you to cull what you've heard and the stuff that's stuck in your mind.
The ocean guy goes, okay, no more offshore oil drilling, period. We had a moratorium on it for 25 years for a good reason. Then Drill Baby Drill came along, and we opened up the offshore, the coastal zone to offshore drilling. Do not do that. Do not put our sensitive fisheries in jeopardy and with nothing in return, because you don't make a dime at the pump, really. It would be pennies, because it's an international market. The oil that the BP drills in our coastal zone does not come to us.
Yeah, it goes in world markets.
Yeah, and then we pay a pretty penny for it. You know, so You're not going to do that. You're not going to drill your way out of in foreign oil dependency. So until you prove to me that you have exhausted absolutely everything for alternative sources of energy and conservation, what happened to conservation? You want to create jobs? The fastest way you can stop using as much oil is conservation. And we don't even talk about that anymore, and it would create tons of jobs. So no more offshore oil drilling is my statement. And even if you in this country think climate change is iffy, I mean, you don't, but you know, a lot of people in the political debate think it's bogus. The rest of the world completely believes it, and the rest of the world is behaving in that way. The Chinese have put $300 billion into alternative sources of energy. Germany is the leader in wind turbine technology that we pioneered. So once again, we're going to have this huge trade deficit because the rest of the world is getting on this new industry that eventually we will all be on. So why are we not doing it? It's just insane because we're holding on to this old, oil and jobs kind of thing.
So you're leading me to my next question. Okay. In 1973, in the first oil crunch, I was living in a caravan of hippie trucks. We were living on the road in these old vehicles, and the gas crunch came. And we were the first people to convert our vehicles to natural.
I'm like a Republican compared to you.
Natural gas.
It's astounding.
So when Jimmy Carter, this is just a little factoid, but it's a good one. When Jimmy Carter set the speed limit at 55 miles a gallon, 55 miles an hour, our consumption of foreign oil dropped 40%.
Overnight.
And had we kept that, we would today be using no foreign oil. So on that point, here's the only thing in the book that surprised me in a, not a totally positive way. So
I'm an actor, for God's sake. I played it too soon, sorry.
So it was not you, it was this fellow. His name's Pete Slaby. He's the vice president of Shell Oil in Alaska. And I thought it was great that you had him in the book.
Yeah.
I thought it was applaudable that you become friends and you listen to his arguments, but he said something that really made the hair stand up on the back of my head. Here's what he said. He said, solar and wind account for 1% of US energy needs. It could take 20 years to grow that to 2%. That remark bothers me for a couple of reasons.
It's good PR.
One is he's an oil producer. He has a vested interest in maintaining that 20 years.
Totally.
And two, as a representative of a corporate power, he has the political power to ensure that it will take 20 years. And what I remember is that I was born the year Pearl Harbor was bombed, and we were flat-footed at the start of that war. Flat-footed.
Yeah.
And in 2 years, we were outproducing the military powers of the world. And so I'm wondering, why are we not somewhere talking about a Manhattan Project style?
Me too.
Yeah, you get it. So yeah.
It's very
we get it.
No, I know. But it's and I'm not Ed Begley Jr. I mean I'm as guilty as Pete, in a way. I mean, I'm not sackcloth and ashes, and
You're not supposed to be. If I can just say one thing, this is one of the things that only government can do.
Right.
You know, I drive a Volkswagen on biodiesel, but I live in a big house. I've got nice clothes. It's our entire culture is a problem, and you can't be personally responsible beyond doing what you can. This is where we need government, not to argue about pro-choice or anti-choice. We need them to be establishing perimeters within which we can live sustainably.
I agree. Well said. Well said.
We took care. Go ahead.
To that note, all the things that you can do, and what the book tells you, this is what's going on, this is what the world needs to do about it, and this is what you can do about it. But while we're on the subject of we need a huge, big effort, the thing that I can offer you that would make the most difference to the oceans? Sounds very self-serving. Buy my book. No. buy my book. It actually will teach you what's going on, what you can do about it, pass it on to other people, get it into the schools. It really is a what's going on and what we need to do, and we need to fix it, and we need to fix it now. It will turn you into an international activist in your crazy, busy lives. Here's what I was really going to say. Go to oceana.org. Oceana.org. It's the organization that I'm on the board of directors. There are many other great ones. I know Oceana. You can go online, click here, and you become a wave maker, which is an e-activist. And then you agree to like take a message from us and saying, hey, something's happening in Belize. Something's happening. We need the fishing councils or have a vote tomorrow. We need you to do da-da-da. 60,000 of you e-activists ended up saving about 140,000 square miles off of the West Coast from bottom trawling. Because people don't, it's out of sight, out of mind. No one ever shows up to talk about oceans. So if you get engaged and involved, and you can do it in 5 minutes a day at minimum, and I encourage you to do more and find your own way to get involved, but oceana.org will turn you into an e-activist that will make a difference to our oceans. And it's because, the reason why I went off on this, a lot of what we're facing right now has such a ticking clock to it that it's not about educating and inspiring. It's about changing policy now. So, and most of that policy needs to be changed from the top down. So you need to be an international activist. And I really encourage you to do it because it's very, very satisfying. You can fit it into your life and it will make a huge difference to the oceans. 1%, did we do this? 1% of the money raised in this country going to environmental causes, 1% goes to oceans, which kind of tells you where we're at about out of sight, out of mind, you know? So, oceana.org, I really encourage you to check it out. Back to you.
I'd like you to take this out of sight, out of mind, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about high seas bottom trawlers, because you taught me a lot about them. This was the typo that we found in the book. The bottom trawlers can destroy 580 square miles. 580 square miles. That's from here to San Diego squared every day. The typo was they had 580 million square miles. I thought
we're several planets every 5 minutes.
But and the other fact that's equally horrifying is that every year these bottom trawlers destroy an area the size of the contiguous United States.
Twice.
Twice.
By the way. Yeah.
So explain to us what that is, how they work, what they're doing, because we can't see them.
Right. And this is the 10% of the fishermen on these fleets that are catching 90% of the fish, and they're doing it this way. One of the things is they destroy the nurseries. They destroy the coral reefs, the rocks, the nooks and the crannies that the little fish, you know.
Explain how.
Grow up and become the big fish. So those, very important area. So what happens is there are these huge trawlers, overly subsidized, so they can go anywhere and forever. Some of them are the size almost of a small aircraft carrier. The nets drag the bottom. They churn up whatever's on the bottom and they catch, hence bottom trawlers. And they, the mouth of some of these, you could fit a 747 from wingtip to wingtip. It's just huge. And they used to have to lift these nets because they would tear on the rocks, but not anymore. The engines are so powerful and the nets and the technology. So now they have rollers and they can literally, it's like if you saw, I can't remember who wrote this, but it was like if you had, you know, two Hummers with this huge chain and you raced down the savannah in Africa or something and just tore up everything and rolled over animals, you'd be horrified, you know, killing, you know, the females and the babies and the this and just totally flattening the area and turning it into a desert. We'd all be horrified. That happens all the time, but at the bottom of the ocean floor. So they turn these coral reefs into, or these rocks and nooks and crannies, into, literally into gravel pits. And they do it, like we said, the size of twice the United States every year. So you can see if you destroy the nurseries at that clip, you can have a real serious problem. They also, because they're these huge nets, they catch whatever's there. But they're after, you know, fish X. So up come all these, you know, other fish, and the world throws away 1/3 of what it catches, dead or dying, every year. 1/3 of what it's caught is thrown overboard. So it's incredibly wasteful as well. And Oceana.org is the what we did was working with the fisheries here and also fishing councils here and also in the Mediterranean. We've set aside about 1 million square miles, and this time it was truly 1 million square miles of ocean floor from bottom trawling. Yeah, what else do I want to say about that? Go.
Okay, that's it was new to me.
Yeah.
So, Barbara Boxer, big champion.
A hero.
And someone I've supported, raised money for, I respect her inordinately. But she had a quote in your book that stopped me again. She said, in these troubled times, we must make preserving and creating jobs our number one priority. And I think I know what you would say.
Yeah, I've already said it, yeah.
Right. But there's something about that that just strikes me as wrong. We're creating jobs that are destroying the earth. And we're doing that to kind of sustain an economic system at root. It was Richard Nixon that suggested giving everyone a guaranteed annual income, a base level of income for all Americans, because he understood there weren't going to be enough jobs, and why give people jobs on big bottom trawlers? And I wonder how we begin to start a dialogue about that subject and that debate.
Right. Well, you know this because you're a huge fan. Like you said, I mean, Barbara's like an ocean hero. What you do is you get rid of the trawlers, which employ 10%, and give you know the 90% of that catch to the rest of the artisanal fishermen who know how to do it, and you will create massive amount of jobs. Do the right thing environmentally. Do the right thing for the oceans, and you will create jobs. You put wind power into the ocean instead of oil rigs, and you will, because it's a new startup industry, by nature, you create three times the amount of jobs that oil, you know, for your $1 million invested into oil, and your $1 million into wind, you create three times the amount of jobs, and the jobs stay here. And if you have an accident, it goes splash. You go, oh, shoot.
Yeah, oops.
Oops.
Yeah. Have you met anybody that has discussed or done any research on what kind of political or economic leverage it would take to get rid of the trawlers, what the weak joints are?
WTO.
Uh-huh.
That would nail it. If you get rid of the subsidies, no one could afford to do that.
I see.
Yeah. Bobby Kennedy has that line that he always gets in trouble with, but show me a subsidy and I'll show you a polluter.
Uh-huh.
You know, but there's a degree of truth in that.
So,
sorry. Get the World Trade Organization is attempting to get rid of subsidies to the world's deep water fishing fleets, these big industrial fleets. If you stop subsidizing them, giving them, you know, taxpayers' dollars to pay for their fuel, to pay for increasing engine size, in other words, enabling them to go out and do the wrong thing, they wouldn't be able to go to to the west coast of Africa and totally pillage those. That's an incredible story. They show up, Europe, you know, shows up in West Africa and says, by golly, you need hospitals. You know, you need roads here. Here's some roads and some hospitals. And then a couple years later, oh, and we'd love to come and buy your fishing rights because you don't really have a fleet. And we do. And they go, ooh, I don't know. And they go, well, the roads and the hospitals, that'll stop, you know, unless, okay. And it almost always goes to somebody at the top who's corrupt, and they have totally laid waste to West Africa and the fishing grounds. And the New York Times did this terrible story. People are dying, the fishermen, because they have to go further and further out in their little teeny wood boats to try to catch any fish at all. So do away with subsidies. And the quote was, Bobby Kennedy, show me a subsidy and I'll show you a polluter.
So you started the evening talking about carbon dioxide.
So do you forgive Barbara Boxer now?
I wasn't blaming Barbara Boxer. It's a national malaise.
Okay.
I mean, I was a hippie. The ultimate idea of freedom for me was not a job.
Yeah. Hey. I'm an actor, same thing.
You started out talking about CO2 and acidification and temperature rise, and you mentioned to me Jane Meyer's New Yorker piece on global warming deniers. And this is something I'd really like to learn some more about, because as far as I'm concerned, global warming is science, it's established science, and I watch these yahoos every day getting up and questioning the science. And I wish you'd talk to us a little bit about who the deniers are and what they're about.
Oh, I would guess. I don't know, really, honestly.
Wrong question for the guy?
No, but I've kind of shot my little information. I was about to say something else. I've done my bit on that. Clearly, oil has a huge lobby, and they spend a lot of money to come up with different science. Some people just don't like the idea of it, and anything that science comes up with has to be wrong. But once again, the only thing I have to say to that, because the science is there, dear Lord, it's there. And the temperatures in the water are rising just enough. So currents are starting to change direction, and coral reefs are starting to dissolve just from the temperature rising, which would have a huge impact on the world's nurseries. Because the coral reefs, although they take up like 1% of the footprint of the ocean, produce 25% of the world's fish. So they're these amazing nurseries. So just from an ocean point of view, to deny climate change is insane. And then, for me, ocean acidification is the real, all right, you can squabble about climate change, but you cannot argue about the amount of carbon dioxide that we're pumping into the atmosphere that falls into the ocean, and that's just science. That's not a cyclical.
And you can measure the pH of the ocean,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and you can see what's happening as a result since the Industrial Revolution. And then my final argument is be smart. We're capitalists. We are about money and making it. So be a smart one, for God's sake. The rest of the world disagrees with you. The rest of the world does think that climate change is real, and they've invested huge amounts of their economy into this new technology. You're going to be the bobo that doesn't go along with it and has to then import all of their technology, and the trade deficit's going to skyrocket because you want to sustain the oil at all costs, and we're going to lose jobs if we stop drilling for oil, and da 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 da.
I was, as you were talking, I was thinking about.
Wait, you weren't soaking up what I was saying?
I was. Yeah, I was actually listening. Remember, acting, talking, listening, receiving. It's what we do. I was thinking in Northern California, particularly in this area, there's been a turn to a kind of positive face of greed. People have decided they wanted fresh food, they wanted local food, they wanted organic food, they wanted organic wines, they wanted minimal sulfates, and it seems that can be, greed can be an engine of social. So I'm hearing that when you're talking about capitalists, we need to get greedy about living in clean water and healthy fish. And
you guys can order, it's embarrassing, but say, excuse me, but is this farm salmon? If it's from Washington State, maybe. But most of our farm salmon comes from Chile, and it's that grinding up 3 to 5 pounds of wild fish to make the 1 pound of farm salmon. So don't just say, sorry, thank you, I need wild salmon, thanks very much. The Monterey Bay Aquarium has this great card, or go if you have an app on your phone, Sea Watch. It's brilliant, and it's fun. It's fun to do the right thing. It really is, and it's very powerful, because then restaurants will go, oh, you care? Great, we care. And then they'll go back to the fish markets, and they say they're caring, and onward and upward. So you guys have a huge amount of power besides becoming international activists.
Oceana.org.
Thank you.
I don't know if you read the book Collapse by Jared Diamond. He's the guy who wrote Gun, Germs, and Steel. But he made a really interesting observation in this book that if you took and you made a map of the 9 environmental hotspots on the planet, and then you made another map of the 9 most politically tumultuous and unstable areas, they're the same. You can supervise one over the other.
Right.
Superimpose them. So when in Rwanda, when Hutus couldn't find Tutsis to kill, they killed other Hutus because they didn't have enough space. So at root, the ocean is the food source for how many people did you cite?
1 billion people depend on it.
1 billion people. So
without it, they don't get protein.
I mean, have you run into any research on the kind of dislocations and violence that people anticipate should they run out of food?
No, I haven't. But I mean, you said it. I mean, you would guess that there would be. You know, if you have an immigration problem now.
Yeah.
You know.
As the water rises and you start losing coastal areas.
And people are starving.
Yeah.
That will happen. So, you know, to be selfish but smart is really good. You know, be a smart, selfish person. And, you know...
Enlightened selfishness.
Yeah, yeah.
So, let me just ask a couple more questions. I'd like you to talk a little bit, because I've done a lot of land-based environmental work. I know a lot about apex predators on land. I know if you kill off the wolves, the forests die. It seems counterintuitive, but when the wolves and coyotes are killed, you get too many raccoons, too many deer, too many animals, and they eat the shrubs and they eat the young trees. What about the apex predators in the ocean?
Yeah, I guess you'd have to be talking about sharks, and we kill about 80 to 100 million shark a year. And it's not a fishery, it's not managed. You just get to do what you want. And
there's no regulations about shark fishing?
No, it's starting now. In this country now, just recently we passed, thanks to Oceana.org, a law against finning, shark finning.
Explain what that is.
Yeah, it's disgusting. Yeah. I think you guys are doing something about even ordering shark fin soup, I think, is going to become perhaps illegal or something. But shark finning, you all know what it is. It's like they catch the shark, it's still alive. Whack, whack, off come the fins, and the shark gets thrown overboard, tries to swim away and swim straight down, and there are these horrible pictures of sharks embedded nose, you know, into the sand because they were still alive and they tried to swim, but they had no fins, so they went straight down. And they fin them because if you landed the entire shark, your little boat would be full after about 10 sharks, but you can do, you know, 1,000 shark fins in your boat and make a lot of money. So we've been fighting against that, and 70 million of that or 60 million or something like that goes to shark fin soup, which is a cultural thing, and some people say it's hard to fight against culture. You know, we have cultural stuff we would defend. Once again, it's be smart. Turn it into a fishery. Manage it like you do things that you want to have around for a long time. So the management thing in this is count them, figure out how much you can take, how big a quota, and then make sure you land the entire carcass. You don't get to bring just fins in anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't it true that a lot of times when you...
Oh.
Go ahead.
Sorry. To answer your question, I'm so trying to just prove that I know stuff that I won't even answer the question. I'll just go to something I know. In North Carolina, when you do away with the top predator, they wiped out all the sharks off their coast, and a couple years later, their scallop industry collapsed because the sharks eat the rays that eat the scallops. No more sharks, the ray population explodes and ate all the scallops. So you just can't mess, especially at the top of the food chain, without having an impact all the way down. And you can't mess with the bottom of the food chain without it having a ripple effect on up.
There was a great line in your book, it was a little red slug line in one of the texts, that we're now eating what our grandparents used to use for bait.
Yeah.
I mean, how much progress is that?
Yeah. And we invent, we hire PR companies to invent, I know, we'll call this really ugly fish orange roughy. Yeah. I want some orange roughy. You know, and it was, you know, anyway.
I want to give the audience a chance to ask some questions, but I just want to take this opportunity to ask one more. It seems that when we look at it, that at the root of every environmental problem, there are two different impulses. One is just a kind of human greedy impulse for more, more, more. I want to get as much as I can. And the other is the way the economy itself is based. That somehow it's legal for a corporation to throw a bunch of boats and stuff together and sell stock and then turn the ocean into a profit-raising animal.
Right.
We don't have a mechanism. During the Reagan presidency, they cut the words fair and balanced from the FCC enabling legislation. It used to be the law that radio and TV stations had to show you all sides of an issue or we citizens could complain and stop their licensing. I'm wondering if that doesn't need to be something we need to revisit, that how can the population of the United States ever know enough about what's going on with single issue, partisan.
Absolutely right.
Flooding the airwaves.
Yes. I agree with you.
Well, that ends that. Can we get, thank
although,
you.
Although it, sometimes I do depend on Fox to get my blood pressure pumping a little bit. Yeah.
Can we get a little light on in the house so we can see people and by show of hands? I will tell you, please wait for a microphone. So I'll call on you and then there'll be a microphone coming by. Let's start in the front row because we can get the microphone to him.
Hi.
And just why not just give us a name and tell us where you're from and what you do?
Yeah, so thank you for this interesting conversation. My name's Joey Shep. I'm the Green MBA program director here. Do you see any emerging business opportunities that actually would help heal the ocean? You know, you talked about wind energy. I know there's tidal, there's algae that could be grown. You know, do you see any opportunities in the business realm that could help the oceans?
And once again, I it's in the book, and I must claim, basically, I'm ignorant about it, but aquaculture will have to be a huge part of our life going forward. It'll be hard to do carnivorous fish, you know, and make that work. But they are starting to invent closed systems where, you know, it literally is, the waste is used to do the da-da-da that grows the da-da-da that the fish eat. And, you know, that you just have to be smart about it. And I think it'll become a very high-tech industry because we will need, you know, there are too many of us now.
Just before I recognize you, I'm going to ask just Stuart Ruddick to come backstage at the end of this event so I can introduce him to Ted. Yes, sir.
Tom Brown, West Marin. I'm a marketing research consultant. My questions concern order of magnitude. You've talked about a couple of things like acidification of the oceans. What is the proportion of negative impact from acidification versus overfishing, for example? And the other question of magnitude is, what is the impact of ocean pollution with trash versus overfishing? If you could just give me some comparison.
I think I'll let Ted handle those.
Yeah. I thought Ted would have the answer to that.
In
thanks.
Second year of Cheers, I found myself. I don't know the exact figures, but if you keep the health of the fisheries as your goal, then then everything that you can't quite count, we don't know how fast ocean acidification or what the impact will have, or how fast it will have an impact, whether fisheries can adapt in time. You know, I mean, that's the imponderable. And that's the reason why you keep your stocks really healthy with a wide margin for error. We don't know what oil is really doing. I mean, a lot of it, we dodged a big bullet. I'm talking about pollution. We dodged a big bullet in the Gulf because, you know, how we were all the news media was, they were called, whatever, we pushed the panic button because it wasn't as bad as we thought. It didn't sweep around, you know, onto the East Coast. If you took the models of what the currents and the wind were doing for the previous 3 years on that exact same day, 1 year it did sweep. It would have swept around, you know, and the year before it would have slammed into the marshes or slammed into Florida. It would have been devastating any of the 3 years before. So God, Mother Nature, whatever, kept it into an eddy that kept it kind of offshore, and it did start to evaporate. But we don't yet know what's going to happen to the nurseries. And, you know, baby dolphins are washing up at a rate about 20 times the normal amount. They don't know why yet, but, you know, there's odds are pollution will have a big impact. Runoff. In Belize, where we work, it's just the runoff that is, you know, threatening their reefs. Even though we stopped all the trawling, they have so much runoff from industry and unregulated stuff that that's a problem. Up here in the Northwest, you have problems with the dams and the paper and timber and everything destroying the salmon runs that are now starving the orcas. And, you know, so it's hard to tell. We have such an impact, man, on the planet. As long as you keep your eye on my motto is keep your eye on the fisheries, keep them healthy with huge margins of air, so that it can withstand the unforeseen and the stuff we don't really know. Did that kind of answer? Right. Yeah, there's a huge island of trash with plastic and a gyro thing that's the size of Texas or something.
Texas.
Yeah. Bad it isn't.
Also, no. we don't know yet. The two departments of oceanology that don't receive money from the oil industry, University of Georgia and University of Florida, are in the Gulf now. And there's a plume of undersea oil. It's about 3,000 feet thick, about 22 miles long. And what worries them and what they're tracking right now is that all the fish and dolphins and mammals go up through it and down through it as they feed at different levels. So it could be another generation before we finally understand the consequences of that.
And we don't know how to clean up that plastic, Texas.
Yes, in the back there with the hand raised.
Thank you. Bob Burton from Mill Valley. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
I think it's a fact that it's very tough to change adults' minds. Mindsets become kind of things that develop over a long period of time. And no matter what evidence we can present, it just seems that it's very hard to change an awful lot of people's minds. So it seems that the long-term future depends on what we do with our kids. And I'd just like to know what, if anything, you think we can do in the educational system, which is enough of a mess as it is, of course, to kind of bring this message to them so that there's some hope for the long term. Thank you.
I agree, although Oceana did not go in that direction, because if we believe our science, the clock is ticking much faster than allowing our kids to grow up and take over the reins and solve this. It really is in our lap now to change our ways, because otherwise it literally could be too late. Some scientists literally targeted 2060 or something like that, where we would fish out our oceans. Once again, it's a trend thing and gets attacked by other scientists, but it basically, I don't know that we have the, Oceana decided that they wanted to change policy now that it would have a direct impact on the oceans. Can I just do a parenthesis here? Because we have been, to raise awareness about what's going on to the oceans, you talk about a lot of negative, scary things. I am a huge believer that if you overwhelm people and you're full of fear, nothing will get done. I truly believe that this is something that we can solve, and we can solve in our lifetime or our children's lifetime. Literally, this is one of those massive environmental disasters we can avoid, and we will know whether or not we did. That's exciting. That's a great challenge. How wonderful, you know? My wife, Mary, says the most important thing you can tell people to do is, and it's Mary Steenburgen. I'm sorry, I have to correct her name. Mary Steenburgen, wonderful actress, and I wish she were here. You'd love her. Go tell people to go out and go to the ocean, go to the beach, go see a sunset, go have a wonderful fish dinner. Remember how much you love the oceans, because it's only out of that space that you'll be able to get anything done. If you come out of fear, you'll probably get discouraged and leave, or you'll flounder around doing negative, angry things, you know? I really believe you need to do this work with a light heart, and it's fun, it's fun.
Yes, hi. In the back.
Hi, I'm Bissy, I'm a junior down at Samarin High. So basically, realistically, how much of an influence can we have on other countries to make a significant change?
Well, it depends, I guess, on what you're talking about. But like, something we didn't talk about was how much pollution shipping puts out into the world. You know, it'd be like if shipping were a country, it'd be something like the 16th worst polluter. So we have this 200-mile, our economic zone is 200 miles out. If you make every ship that comes into our 200-mile, you know, reduce this, a la Carter, reduce the speed limit, you know, you will pump way less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. This is just one little piece. We haven't done this yet in this country. Seafood fraud is rampant. Like 25% of the fish you think you're eating, you're not, according to the FBI. And so I know it's a big deal, you know. I made tilapia cheap over here, and I'm selling it as something really pricey. Another good news thing is that you do not have to create some huge, unwieldy, unenforceable international body to do this. You can go country by country, which is what something Oceania is starting to do. Because all the fisheries mostly take place in the 200-mile economic zone of each country, because, you know, the coastal zone is where all the nutrients are and the little fish and oxygen and all of that. So if you go country by country, showing them how to manage their fisheries in a way that is sustainable, most countries will go along with that, you know, and are interested and want to know that. Get the number of boats off the water, you know, by encouraging the World Trade Organization to cut subsidies. There are things you can do to impact other countries, especially the World Trade Organization, because it has teeth. You know, if you break your trade agreement, there are penalties that hurt. I think going country by country is the way to do it. Are you semi-satisfied with that? And you know what? I don't know. I bet you if you get involved, you'll think of something too. We need really bright people, you know, who are energized coming into it with new and wonderful ideas.
We need a mic down here.
Ted, hi. I have a question. I'm Joanne from Mill Valley. And Ecuador has amended their constitution and recognizes Mother Earth as having rights. And I believe that everything we're talking about here tonight, while there are things we can do at a grassroots level, while there are things, differences we can make personally, we can make differences, I think that it's essential that there is some type of movement toward our constitution, starting in this country, recognizing Mother Earth as having certain rights, And having lawmakers, having World Trade, having all of those organizations have to be able to stand to that commitment and to abide by that law. I don't believe that we can really make the kind of change we're talking about and save the ocean and save the fish and save people from hunger until we actually start to look at the fact that the earth has absolutely no rights right now by any virtue of any kind of law.
I agree. That's what Peter was saying, too. You know, I have been so kind of trained to find ways to talk into this, the energy of this the country right now, which is the economy and jobs, you know, that I agree with you 100%. That's how I grew up around the Hopi in Arizona, and they, you know, they have to have a total reverence. Their entire spirituality is based on, you know, their relationship to the earth. And, you know, and that's the truth. What you just said is the truth. And it's really hard to get people to listen in the town square when you talk about a spiritual thought like that. But it's the truth, you know. So good for you, and, you know, talk it up that way. Absolutely.
I think one thing to consider is that we're all parts of a mosaic, and Oceania is a piece of the mosaic, and it has its own shape and its own color and texture. And you've just outlined another piece of the mosaic, and I think the best thing to do for everybody that has this idea or sees something that's missing here is to be the basis of your own mosaic tile.
Absolutely. If you just get in, stick your toe in the water, you'll start thinking of things to do. And the best part about, you all know this, I'm here in the land of activism, but, you know,
there was someone
look who I'm sitting with, you know, but becoming part of the solution is so, feels so good to your body as opposed to being, you know, slammed by one more thing from the newspaper or the news that is just like, ah. And whenever you turn your back on something disastrous in the world, your body takes a hit, you know? So it's great to become active and do something. Teeny, do anything. It'll make you feel
You're good. Reminding me of when I used to drive my son to school, and I would be talking to him on the way in, and just before he would put his iPod headphones in, he would say, "Bummer of the day, huh, Dad?" We had someone down here who had their, yes. You see this, wait for the microphone.
Hi, my name is Marcy and I'm sitting next to Jules and we work together. We wanted to tell you about a project that we're gonna be doing that I think is something that everybody here would really be interested in hearing about. There's a man that makes sustainable coral reefs down off the coast of Cancun, and his name is Jason DeCare Taylor, and we're going to be making a documentary on him, and what he does is he makes lifelike statues from live human models, and then he installs them on the ocean floor in his underwater museum, and it serves as becoming a new habitat for marine life, and it also, they plant corals, so it coral has time to regenerate. And then it also diverts the divers away from the natural reefs that are really in need of privacy to regenerate. And it's hauntingly beautiful what he does because these statues are made from live people and in all kinds of positions and depicting all sorts of different walks of life. And it's so mysterious and so awe-inspiring that it seems to us that this is the kind of documentary that would really inspire people to think about, because we're gonna work into the documentary all these facts and things that you're talking about. And it seems to us, Jules and I, that this is a way to inspire young people. Somebody mentioned in the back, you know, how do we get people energized about this? And for us as artists, we take the artist route. And we are really interested in doing this documentary, and we just wanted to mention it because we would love for people to know about it, support it.
Right.
It's going to be coming up, and we'll start filming soon. So
I'll narrate it for you.
That would be great. We, you know, we actually have some information packets because we weren't going to approach you till afterwards. But we have some information packets with photos and everything. And when you see what we're talking about, and if you Google this guy, Jason DeCare Taylor, which is, a lot of his stuff has been viral online, you know, Googling lately, so a lot of people here might know who he is. But he is just so inspired. So we hope that, you know, you'll take a look at the packet.
Just go to petercoyote.com and you can send me a letter. It'll come right to me.
Where?
PeterCoyote.com.
Okay, and I also, we have packets here for you tonight. So
what's your budget for narrating? Because he's pretty expensive.
$118,000 is what we're trying to raise to make the film.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's my fee that I'm waiving.
What?
Do we have some more? Oh, wait. We have time for a couple more right here. See this man?
Yes.
Pale
sweater? I wanted to say that, you know, I like to watch all the stuff. I watch Fox News, MSNBC. My name is Fred Yage. I live in Stinson Beach. I was a deputy public defender. I was a deputy DA. Both sides have something to say, but just one point about global warming, I wanted to know if you agree. It's not whether the science on global warming, it's the fact to reduce pollution in the world.
Wait, say that last part.
I think that we can all agree that we want to reduce pollution in the world. Nobody wants their kids to be in a polluted world.
Right.
That's the essence of it for me. Global warming and science, then people can deny it. You can't deny that you want to reduce pollution. So it's better to frame it as, in the future, for our grandkids, we want a less polluted world.
Right.
Global warming allows people then to be deniers.
Yeah, you know, you're right. It's like saying planet and blue and green. It turns people off.
That's it.
No, seriously, you're right. If you can find ways to frame the argument so that people get it and it's not some feels like an people tell me, do not say habitat, you know, say nursery, you know, for a reason, because one are kind of buzzwords that tune, you know, are rejecting.
There was a fellow here in a pit. Yeah, there he is. Oh, you got it.
Hi, I'm Dirk Rosen with Marine Applied Research. One of the things that's tough about the ocean is that we can't see, it's opaque. We can't go down and see the seafloor. And yet the monitoring we need to do is going to take a lot of time to see if things are improving. Does Oceana.org have, do you encourage science and some of the long-term monitoring that we need to do to see if we're making any changes?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, I'm the clown up front, please. We are of the tent. We have amazing scientists. I don't know if you know Dr. Daniel Pauly at the, where is he, in Vancouver at the, what is that called, that University of British Columbia. And he's one of the most renowned scientists. We lead the way. We're a campaign organization. We are campaigners. But we have science up the wazoo. We really lead with science, or else you're you know, you make terrible mistakes and you do nothing. So I encourage you to go online. This is not a trap. You know, go online and ask those questions and you will get a response from people who are working in the field.
I think we have time for two more questions.
I know I didn't answer that, but go online and you will get your answer.
There's a woman in the back, see off the aisle there. There she is. Yes, her.
Yes, my dad built the revolving roundhouse in Marin. And of course, at that time, we didn't have enough money to do solar power. You know, wind power, my dad, everybody laughed at the fact, the half-gallon drums, wind power, in order to compete with PG&E. Now, what do you think about solar power in order to help with the conservation of this planet?
Probably know more about it than I do.
Yes,
I
have met you, Peter Coyote.
Oh, you knew he knew.
Well, Roundhouse Renee.
This leads back to my question about why is it going to take 20 years to go from 1% to 2%? Oh. Federal subsidies keep gasoline cheap. It's the same kind of subsidies that keep the boat in the water. If we began to diminish the subsidies to gasoline, these things, solar power and wind power and tidal engines and all of these geothermal power would be more competitive. But the Coal and Petroleum Institute spends $1 million a week on Washington-only advertising. So we've got to sort of generate enough static and noise and passion to counter that.
And don't leave out conservation. It is the fastest, cheapest, most readily available way to attack this problem.
Okay, who's gonna close us out? Back here.
Hi, Leslie Crane, professor of nursing. I teach health policy here on campus and try to encourage development of nurse activists by giving them some concrete things that they can do to act as advocates. And Ted, you said in your book that there are a number of things in the book that individuals can do. I'd like to ask for the benefit of those who may not have the opportunity to read the entire book right away.
Who could that be?
in the middle of all the rest of their studies, let's say. Could you just mention one or two things, concrete things that people can do?
Sure, they're the obvious things. You know, they are reducing your carbon footprint is huge. I mean, I'm here to talk about oceans, but the big gorilla in the room is energy, really, you know. And climate change. So reducing your carbon footprint is the most amazing thing you could do. You can do silly but very practical things like take your cloth bag like your parents did to the supermarket. In my family, we have a rule. It doesn't matter. You either carry it out barehanded or you buy another cloth bag. In the back of my car, I got about 400,000 cloth bags. But, you can do that, you know, keep plastics out. You can, you know, don't be a do-it-yourself oil changer and dump it down. Know that you are like, the beach begins in your backyard. So whatever you're putting down your, you know, cleaners and things down your sinks and your drains ends up in the ocean. So be conscious and aware of that. Being a smart, loud consumer will have a huge impact. And this is not just me tooting Oceana's horn. You really need to find a way to have your voice heard on an international level. You need to get into that conversation because these policies are worldwide, the problems are worldwide, and they are, you know, you need to be talking to the heads of countries. And you can do that. There are other organizations that do this too. I know about Oceana. So I really encourage you to become a wave maker, you know, very satisfying.
The one thing you might think about too is aggregation. You know, it's the way nature works. A baby is an aggregation of cells. A tumor is an aggregation of cells. Drop, drop, drop of water makes the Grand Canyon. Where do we aggregate our money? We use credit cards. Is your credit card owned by a corporation that's helping the planet or hurting it? You can check it out.
Yeah.
Is your bank helping the planet or hurting it? Are you using driving more than you need to? And finding like-minded people and aggregating our work makes us a huge force. So a couple announcements. I think Ted and I are going to be available to sign books. I want to remind people that a book passage, a local treasure, an independently owned bookstore has this book. Don't leave here without it tonight. It's a great encyclopedic source for any area of this subject that you want to learn.
And funny. Funny.
It's the difference between the big, tall Sam Malone and the Jew with the animal name. Right. Anyway, thank you all very much. I thank Ted. We'll be around.